for himself and his family out of the soil in a battle with nature. Many of them are bedroom communities for office workers in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. They are not to be confused with the kibbutzim movement, who were the original founders of Israel. These were communal organizations who worked together tilling the land and providing for their needs from the work of their hands. They were not religious zealots but were, for the most part, secular socialists. David Shipler, in his book, Arab and Few, Wounded Spirits in a Promised Land, that we have referred to earlier, has provided some illuminating comments regarding the nature of the West Bank settlers. There were several waves of settlers. The bulk of the religious, ideologically driven Israelis took up their stations on the West Bank in the 5 years or so beginning with Begin's election in 1977, although small vanguards of them squatted illegally here and there from 1968 onward. That fundamentalist movement was bracketed, before and after, by mostly secular Jews who settled the West Bank for non-religious reasons, both in the early years after 1967 and beginning in the early 1980s. The third wave, 1980s wave of settlers, went most in search of economical housing, made possible by government subsidies unavailable in major cities. They did not need a comprehensive system of faith to move them to the satellite towns that were serving as bedroom communities for Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. The middle group was the important one in shaping the ideological framework of the movement. Led by the Gush Emunim activists, those settlers, most of them with higher education, forged an amalgam of religious and nationalist impulses that took them to barren stony hilltops where they practically camped in small house trailers for several years until the government built them permanent apartments. They were driven by a search for biblical heritage, military security, and personal fulfillment, with the mixture of these components varying in each individual. Some stressed the secular, pioneering objectives, and many found a modest religious revival in the new communities. Strangely, despite these settlers' avowed reverence for the land, I never encountered any who seemed to have any feeling for it. None had the farmer's devotion to working the land they claimed to love. They used it as a place of residence, a symbol of their faith and their history, an abstraction, but they almost never turned a spade or plowed a furrow. I never saw a pious settler in the hills of Judea and Samaria hold a clump of raw earth in his hand and watch it, and smell it as he crushed it, and sifted it between his fingers. As the Jewish townships spread from the rocky hilltops into the more arable valleys, advancing bulldozers cut swaths and scars through the Arabs' vineyards and small fields of winter wheat, which were then left fallow by the newly arrived Jews. One settlement I know kept a herd of sheep, another grew flowers in a hothouse. Some settlements built small factories on their land, but by and large their residents commuted to work in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. After the guerrilla war in Algeria, when the French finally decided to grant Algeria independence, they brought back more than a million of their colonists and settlers from Algeria, whose ancestors had been there for up to 130 years. 70,000 West Bank settlers, therefore, should not cause any great resettlement problem. Also, it should not be forgotten that, for 40 years, 700,000 innocent Palestinians have been uprooted from homes occupied for generations and still do not live in homes, but in camps. As to the obligation of the religious extremists not to give back a single foot of the sacred lands of the West Bank and Gaza, their consciences may be alleviated somewhat by the pronouncements of a convocation of learned rabbis dealing with this question. According to a report in the Jerusalem Post of August 12, 1989, there is a dispute among the rabbis as to whether, according to the Torah, it would be permissible to give up any of the occupied land. A majority said no. However, according to the Post, Citizens' Rights Movement MKDDs are met with the chief rabbis, and extracted from them assurances that, if the government nonetheless decided on a territorial withdrawal, they would see themselves bound by the decision, and take no action against it. Many leading scholars, according to the Jerusalem Post, October 28, 1989, including Avadia Yosef, Shas, and Eliezer Schach, Dejel HaTorah, have ruled illogically that peace, not land, is the loftiest value. Reprise and epilogue. In concluding, we turn briefly to the beginning chapter of our thesis and quote again from Barbara Tuchman's The March of Folly, which she explains, is the pursuit by governments of policies contrary to their own best interests. She cites, as a classic example, the fate of the Jewish kingdoms of Israel and Judah and the price paid by the Jewish people for the folly of King Rehoboam. The kingdom of Judah, containing Jerusalem, lived on as the land of the Jewish people. It suffered conquest too, and exile by the waters of Babylon, then revival, civil strife, foreign sovereignty, rebellion, another conquest, another farther exile and dispersion, oppression, ghetto and massacre but not disappearance. The alternative course that Rehoboam might have taken, advised by the elders, and so lightly rejected, exacted a long revenge that has left its mark for 2,800 years. Emphasis supplied the continuing folly and failures of many of the leaders of the ancient Hebrew kingdoms and their historical consequences to the Jewish people are recounted in detail in chapter 1 of this book. We saw that the Romans first became the masters of the Jews, not by conquest, but because they were invited to rule the kingdom of Judah and to settle the internecine quarrels and dissension among the Jews. Abram Sacher comments on the phenomenon, freedom was again crushed out, because the Jews had not learned how to use it. The selfishness of the ruling houses and the strife of political and religious factions exhausted the strength of the state. A curse seemed to lie on the Jews which prevented them from reaching the highest levels of moral power, except when they were hammered and beaten by today. Israel again faces a crisis of leadership, and is called upon to make choices which may determine the fate of Israel forever. In his recent book, entitled The Chosen and the Choice, Israel at the Crossroads, author Jane Jack's servant Scriba 10 relates his conversations with a number of Israelis, including Shimon Peres, and expresses his views concerning the golden opportunity which the future holds for an Israel. I come across urgent calls from Jews in anguish for a revision of old doctrines. The head of a religious high school in Jerusalem writes, on this our 40th anniversary I cannot help seeing our nation as beset with pain and anguish. We feel lost. I wonder what Isaiah would say today, if he were among us, leaning against the walls of Jerusalem. There is nothing new under the sun, have we not always destroyed our achievements with our own hands? Can we not recall before our eyes a whole 2,000-year history of recurrent self-destruction? I dream that someday I shall be able to tell my pupils about the rediscovery of the good life in our God-given land. We must do something more than just perpetuate our defense by military means. We have to heal the wounds in ourselves and our enemies. We have to reinvent peace. Yes, a more far-seeing form of Zionism, emphasis supplied. Among his other observations, servant Scriba states that something new must be created in the spiritual field by the Jewish people, if they want an Israel that is faithful to its destiny and able to fulfill its potential. I now may be the last chance for Israel to fulfill its promise, not the promise of the land but the promise of its people. I have long believed that what Israel desperately needs is a prophet. However, my opinion has now changed. Israel has its prophets Abaddon, Yehoshaphat Huckabee, Simcha Flapan, Amos Perlmutter, to name a few. Sadly, however, as with the prophets of old, no one is listening. Source notes: I. The March of Folly 1. Tuchman, Barbara W. The March of Folly. New York, Alfred A. Knopf, 1984. 4-2. Ibid 5-3. Sacher, Abram L. A History of the Jews. New York, Alfred A. Knopf, 1984. 43-4. Tuchman, 10-11, 5. Sacher, 44-45, 6. Or Subel, Nathan. Book of Jewish Knowledge. New York, Crown, 1964, 7. Johnson, Paul. A History of the Jews. New York, Harper and Row, 1987. 78. Sacher, 57, 9. Ibid 74, 10. Ibid 84, 11. Ibid 105, 12.